This is episode 354, dated Friday, April 7th, 2024.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco. This is episode 354, dated Friday, April 7th, 2024. Allow me to introduce my friend and colleague and co-host, Peter O'Toole. Peter, what's going on today?
It's, you know, early spring in Coos Bay, which means that it's sunny and sort of chilly and sort of windy with the occasional rain downpour. But it's supposed to be a bunch of nice weather next week, so we're looking forward to that.
Wonderful. It snowed in parts of New England yesterday. It was pretty bad. It knocked out some power in parts of New Hampshire, from what I heard. So
heavy wet snow is the worst kind.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Before we continue with our special guest, let me introduce some people who deserve thanks for making In Perspective available to us. We start out with our producer, Raymond Gay. Thank you for what you do. Thank you to Lynn and Tom from Rosie's Place for posting the shows up on your chat line bulletin boards. Also, the media outlets, I want to thank you for airing In Perspective when you do. It's much appreciated. And Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions. You archive our shows on my website. Anybody who wants to go to listen to the archives, just go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on them, and you will see our archives from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
And I want to thank Jeanette for taking the time today to be our host for today's episode. Jeanette, thank you for being with us and for helping us out. And also Brad for streaming on ACB Media 5. So with that in mind, let me give out my email address for those people especially who listen on the stream and don't necessarily know how to reach us. If you have any questions or comments about our programs, please feel free to email bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of In Perspective. I'm very pleased today to have Mary O'Brien with us. Mary is an author. She wrote an autobiography, and she's going to be talking about that book and her experiences and what led her to write the book. Mary, what's the title of that book again? I want to make sure I have it properly correct.
All right. It's My Imagination and Art Have Sustained Me.
My Imagination and Art Have Sustained Me. That's the name of Mary's book, ladies and gentlemen, and she's here to talk about it. Mary, you and I have a lot in common. We both went to Perkins. The only thing is, I left about a year before you arrived, but we all know a lot of the same people.
Yes, we do.
I believe you graduated in 1980, and I graduated in 1977.
Yes, that's right.
So tell us about what led you to write your book. I know it's a long and complicated story, but you can start wherever you would like, and I'm sure that Peter and I will chime in, and eventually our listeners will chime in with any questions that we have.
All right. What led me to write the book is basically it's a how not to raise your children or teenagers. All they have to do is read what I went through and what some of my friends went through, and they should shake their heads and say, I don't want to be like that. You know, I'll never treat kids that way. And then there's being disabled also, what that was like in various schools. Perkins was the best of all, though. When I left the Elan School in Maine and was transferred to Perkins School for the Blind, I literally felt like I had been taken out of hell and placed in heaven. That's exactly how it felt. I was put in for the summer school, 78. It was such a magical summer. Hardly anything went wrong. It was just such a wonderful atmosphere. Everybody was different there than they had been at Elan.
So you were treated very well by the house mothers and by the teachers and by the other staff members.
Oh, yes.
Mary, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I was just going to say the highlight of that summer was that movie Grease. And of course, disco was popular, and those two things always bring that summer back to me.
Absolutely. The beginning of disco and the high point of Grease. I remember that very, very clearly.
Yes. I loved that movie.
Mary, why the title?
Because my imagination and my drawings did get me through a lot. I don't know what I would have turned out like if I didn't have them.
And how did that work? In other words, you're going, and we'll talk about some of the challenges you experienced, but how did that work? I know in many cases they kept trying to take your pictures away and all that kind of stuff. How did you find the space to draw and write, or how did that all work?
Well, first off, I always had a vivid imagination. I had imaginary friends in place of the people who hurt me. And I started drawing at a young age. And of course I drew people who interested me. I would turn to them for comfort or entertainment. And I would always carry the pictures around with me. And people let me until I went to a lawn, and then they took everything away from me. My stuffed animals, my dolls, my drawings, you know, the whole thing. They said, you like this stuff better than people, so we're not going to let you have it. That was their response, you know?
So I want to come back to Alon, but before we do that, I want to talk. There was a quote that got my attention early in the book where you write something along the lines of, my parents coddled me. They didn't cuddle me. Talk about that. What was that like?
What it means is they overprotected me because of my sight. They kind of treated me like an invalid, but they didn't pick me up and hold me. They didn't cuddle me on their laps, you know. They'd give me a hug and a kiss or something, but they weren't really affectionate. They were mostly just overprotective. And I was a hyper kid, even when I was very little. So I didn't have much patience with being overprotected.
So, I think you're being generous to your mother, especially. She didn't, yeah. It's a question of you, her not, I don't think she liked you very much. The way she surely didn't treat you very well most of the time.
I know. She was furious with me because I never bonded with her. I was adopted when I was almost a year old, but because of her problem, for the first 5 years of my life, I was bounced back and forth between the infant home in my adopted home, and I bonded with one of the nuns, Sister Jane, and my mother was so jealous. And not only that, but she wanted me to be like a very grown up and pious little girl, and I wasn't like that. So well, no, she probably didn't like me very much.
So Mary, I have a question that this arouses my curiosity, and I got a feeling that a lot of our listeners are curious.
Yes.
If your mother was the jealous type,
mm-hmm.
Why did she give you up in the first place?
No, I'm talking about my adopted mother.
Oh, your adopted.
She was made to give me up because she was 16 at the time, and my grandmother wouldn't let her keep me.
Because she was too young.
Right. But
I guess.
What I'm talking about is my adopted mother.
Your adopted mother, you didn't bond very well with your adopted mother.
No, I didn't. I bonded with my dad, all right. But I looked at Sister Jane as my mother.
Yes.
You know, and my adopted mother was furious. I'm going to call her Mrs. O'Brien.
Because, okay, Mrs. O'Brien. Yep.
That was my adopted mother.
Right.
So, yeah, she was very jealous. And she started out being hurt. She started out being hurt, and then the hurt turned to anger.
I see.
She used to lash out at me.
Yeah.
My sense is initially he was hard to deal with because he didn't support you very much. He sort of sat by and watched a lot of this stuff. And then over time, you bonded better with your dad. Is that a fair assessment?
I bonded best with my father when I was very, very young. And then as I started to get older, 5, 6, and 7, I didn't feel that close bond with him anymore because the only time he intervened was when my mother was trying to hit me. He would stop that. But he let her perform exorcisms on me and yell at me, you know. And, like, he would never offer me comfort. In fact, used to get impatient with me when I cried.
Yeah.
So I couldn't turn to him. I drifted away from him as time went by.
What was the purpose of the exorcisms?
Because my adopted parents were very Catholic. Now, I don't know who gave my mother, Mrs. O'Brien, the idea that performing exorcisms on me would make me a good girl, but she believed it. And I had to train myself to hold still and not flinch when she was splattering holy water in my face, because if I flinched, she saw it as further proof of my evilness. So I had to lay perfectly still.
So you obviously had a, you were visually impaired, right? You were
yes.
Like high partial, it sounds like. And I have that.
Yeah, from birth.
From birth. Did you other diagnosed disabilities growing up as well? You mentioned maybe ADHD. Were there other things or?
ADHD, ADD, and emotional problems.
Sure. Yeah, well, that makes sense. So talk about Sister Jane for a moment. You know, she obviously played a really critical part of your life early, and then later you reconnected with her.
Yes, she was like a mother to me for the first 5 years of my life, on and off. And, you know, I was volleyed back and forth for the first 5 years, but I reconnected with her when I was 23. And I looked, you know, I went to the Catholic diocese, found out that her order of nuns had been shipped back down south, and they put me in touch with her, and we started calling each other, writing to each other, and then I visited her during the summer when I was 23. But nothing really developed of that. You know, she didn't invite me to stay down there with her or anything. So I came back.
She did support you a lot over the phone.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and she did. Yeah.
She was a stabilizing force for you, you know, as a young adult, you know, person, from my reading of the book.
Yes.
So one of the things that struck me about the book that was very hard to read was how you were sort of placed first in sort of psychiatric hospitals. And you had trouble in the psychiatric hospitals and rebelled. And so they try to find a place for you to heal or something. And they sent you to this place called Elan.
Yeah.
Talk about that. Cause that's a major part of the book. Talk about, too painful.
What they were looking for was a school that would keep me no matter how many times I ran away, because I had become a chronic runaway by the time I was 12. So when they heard about Elan, they said, great, here she is, take her, cure her of being a runaway. And so I was sent up there. After 3 years, I was placed in a foster home, which only lasted a little over 3 months. And then I went back to Elan for another 2 years before going to Perkins. But Elan was horrible.
Yeah, well, talk about the basic how Elan worked. Because yeah, it really was nerve-wracking to read that part of the book.
Well, it was run by Joe Ritchie and Dr. Gerald Davidson. Though, for me at least, Dr. Davidson was overshadowed by Joe Ritchie. We saw a lot more of him. I personally saw a lot more of him than I did the doctor. But he set up this program. It was originally supposed to be for hardcore junkies who had nowhere else to go. But he started widening the door to let in teenagers who were drug addicts, alcoholics, and kids who had been in a lot of trouble with the law. And then about the time I was 12, he started letting in kids who didn't have any problems with the law, but were runaways and had behavior problems. And even he at first didn't think I belonged there. I overheard him telling students that I didn't belong in that program. But a few days later, I was called upstairs, and he said that I was staying because Rhode Island didn't want me back, not until I changed. And that's when he took everything away from me, and he assigned me a personal overseer, a young girl who would be with me 24/7 to make sure I didn't try to draw or try to take any stuffed animals from anybody else, you know. And Alon had ranks in it, not military ranks, more like workplace ranks. You started out as a worker, and then if you did well, you were promoted to a ramrod, which was like a foreman. I don't know why they didn't just say that. Then a department head, then a coordinator, which would be above the department head, and then the senior coordinator, which was in charge of all the coordinators. And then the separate one was the expediters. They were always referred to as like the police force of the house. They'd patrol different parts of the house and tell people to hurry up and get moving when they were doing their work. They kept incident books where they'd write down anybody who did anything wrong or said something wrong. And then one expediter was on headcount duty, constantly going around checking off everybody's names because people used to run away from there naturally. And so they wanted to keep the upper hand on them. If, you know, they wouldn't be gone long before the expediter realized they were missing, and then they'd send out trackers. And they had all kinds of punishments up there, spankings, getting yelled at.
That wouldn't be allowed today.
Huh? No. Nope.
That wouldn't be allowed today.
No, thank God. They'd make you sit in the corner sometimes for a week or more. A general meeting was something that everybody took part in. The place was based on peer pressure. But only your peers showed you positive peer pressure. You know, the directors would have kids hitting other kids, running up to scream in the person's face in a general meeting, slamming them against the wall. Huh?
How old would you say were the average, what would be the average age of the kids who stayed there?
14 through 18, maybe.
14 through 18, that sounds about right.
They had a few adults there, too, who had drug problems. There were some people there who were in their 20s. Hardly any of them had behavior problems, so they were able to get through the program pretty well.
But I would imagine with you having ADHD and, you know, all your outlets, your healthy outlets being taken away from you, you know, that was a real struggle for you, I would imagine.
It was awful. I took to ripping pictures out of history books and carrying those around with me since they wouldn't let me draw. Sometimes I'd be able to sneak and draw, but sooner or later somebody would find the picture, snatch it away from me and rip it up. I used to get so mad. There was this funny scenario that occurred more than once where somebody snatched a picture away from me, and as they were walking away, I jumped on their back. And I was reaching over their shoulder for the picture, and they were looking over their shoulder and turning round and round in an attempt to try to shrug me off of them.
Mary, what you're describing, Mary, is cruel and unusual punishment. Didn't anybody take these people to task for what they were doing to the clients?
Not really.
A lot of this stuff is not acceptable.
I know. First off, all mail was screened before people were allowed to read it. And outgoing mail was also screened before it was sent out. And when you were allowed to make a phone call to your family, somebody would be on the other extension listening in so that you couldn't say anything about what was going on. You know, you just knew that somebody was on the other end. A person could end up getting a general meeting for blowing the whistle on a lawn in a phone call.
And just to reinforce the point, what is a general meeting? What happened during a general meeting? What were the kinds of things that went on during a general meeting?
All right, I'll use an example. There was a boy named Chuck there. He was a really nice guy, but he got into some kind of trouble. And the staff and directors were saying, you got to tell your mother that she babied you too much and, you know, you were afraid of her and all this. And they invited her to a lawn one day, and they set up group therapy, and he was supposed to yell at his mom and tell her exactly how she made him feel. But he didn't do it. He backed down. So they gave him a general meeting. They slammed him against the wall, yelled, screamed, and swore at him, and then interrogated him afterward. And then they cut his hair real short, gave him he already wore glasses to begin with. They cut his hair real short, made him wear boys dress dress-up shirt, white, with suspenders, a bow tie, and a pair of black shorts to make him look like an old-fashioned Sunday school boy. And they, you know, they were humiliating him for being a mama's boy. And then after that, when they were done wasting him, they took me and two other girls downstairs. The lights were off, and I started hearing whispering. And as the whispering got a little louder, I could hear a group of people saying, kill them, kill them. And then when they were screaming it, the lights were thrown on, and everybody rushed us, you know, yelling and screaming at us. And they pushed us against the wall. They weren't allowed to hit or kick us, and we certainly couldn't hit or kick, and we couldn't even talk back.
Mary, I'm about to make a very powerful statement, and I don't care how it comes out. I hope Alon is not open today. I hope they close their doors.
Because of an online campaign against Alon, it was shut down on April 1st of 2011.
Hallelujah.
But that's the good news. The bad news is it was open for at least 30 years. Right?
I was just going to say that, Peter. It took that long for them to make that decision.
Yeah, crazy. I mean, it's I don't know how to respond. I mean, it just reading that part of the book was heartbreaking and sort of infuriating and was very, very hard to read. Not because the writing wasn't good, because it was. It's just, you know, hard to read that, the kind of stuff that went on. You did mention that some of the punishments involve putting people in boxing rings. And,
yes. If you hit somebody, they would beat you up in the boxing ring. Even if you had fighting skills, they would see to it that you lost because your opponent was fighting for the house, meaning everybody else, you know. So if you had any fighting skills, they'd put you in with someone a little bigger and faster. Because the idea was you were supposed to lose. You were supposed to be beaten.
So, you know, you've been through this for 5 years.
Yeah.
How did Perkins come into your life? How did that happen?
Well, one of the teachers at Alon had looked into it. He was my tutor my second year at Alon, where he was put in charge of finding another school for me. And he told me about Perkins. And like I said, when I went there for the summer school session, which was an evaluation period for me, I just fell in love with the place. It was so totally different.
And talk about that difference a little bit. I mean, you did a little bit, but talk about sort of how it was for you to come to this, you know, from this sort of regimented, brutal place to Perkins, which is anything but well, it is regimented, but it's really not violent.
It's not nearly as regimented as Alon was. It was just a whole different atmosphere. It was relaxed and friendly. People didn't scream at you. They might speak sternly to you if they had to, but they sure didn't scream at you. You know, the punishments were very mild. You know, for instance, there was this girl that was working on a loom, but she was supposed to stop that and help prepare supper, and she didn't. So she had to go without supper that night. So she went over to the snack bar and got something to eat.
Probably not so nutritious, though.
No.
But that punishment strikes me as more reasonable than, you know, being thrown to a boxing ring, you know.
True.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. So talk about your experience. My sense is you were sort of behind education-wise. You know,
that's why I don't understand why I wasn't allowed to be in secondary services. It would have done me a world of good. You know why I think? I think it's because Rhode Island didn't want to pay for me to be there for 4 years. I think that's why they did it.
What are secondary services, just for us?
Special program, you know, like special ed.
Okay. So, you were, but and this sort of raises a question that you sort of answered, but I'm wondering if you have any more thoughts about it.
Yeah.
Why weren't you sent to Perkins when you were 12 years old or 10 years old or 8 years old? And
10 years old would have been the ideal time to send me there. I would have grown up there and did fine. By the time I was 12, I was a runaway. So I probably would have run away from Perkins too at some point. So they
and they probably knew that. Whoever was in charge of you probably knew
they
that.
Did, yeah, time. They did because of my track record.
So do you?
When I was, yes.
So I guess my question is, you know, what a waste of your life for 7 years from 10 till 17. Do you have any idea why they chose to put you where they put you instead of sending you to Perkins when you were 10 years old?
Well, when I was being discharged from the psychiatric hospital in Rhode Island, they wanted to put me in a school up in Lancaster, Massachusetts, but I wasn't accepted there for some reason. And so they just kind of halted everything. Nobody did anything to try to get me into a school. And then in November, when I was like 10 and a half, all of a sudden I'm assigned a caseworker from State Services for the Blind. And she started looking for schools for me. And because I had showed signs of regression, I was put back in the hospital as an outpatient, which meant that I was in their school program. But because of how things were at home, I ran away. So they put me out at the Rhode Island Medical Center for a month, and then they shipped me off to Boston, to the Boston Center for Blind Children. And I was there almost a year, but I got into an argument with one of the staff members, and I ran away. And then in the spring, when I turned 12, they tried to get me into a school up in Fall River, but I ran away from there, too.
Yeah.
And another school just turned me down flat out. And so they said, oh, here's a lineup in Maine. They keep runaways. Let's send her there. Joe Ritchie in the beginning tried to send me back. But Rhode Island said, no, you dummy down the program for her if you have to. We don't want her back until she's changed.
And do you think you changed at Elon? Or let me ask the question differently. How do you think you changed at Elon?
Well, in the positive sense, I learned the value of work, and I learned a little bit of self-control, and I learned that it doesn't really pay to run away from a place because you'll just be taken back or there'll be some sort of consequence. But, like, emotionally, I was worse off. I was more disturbed than when I entered. I had more problems, but I could sort of contain them. Better than I could as a 12-year-old anyway, you know?
Because, you know, in reading sort of the part of the book from your adult life, there are, many good things about your adult life. But, you understandably had all, you know, you had temperamental outbursts, you know, throughout your adult life, you know?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of hard to read, you know, it just sort of... Mm. I don't even know how to say this. I mean, it just sort of, it's just a shame, you know, that you were there for 5 years and you had to deal with the consequences of that emotional, you know, brainwashing as it were.
Yes.
So I want to turn a corner and ask you to talk about your religious background. You talked about growing up as a sort of a hardcore, to use, that's my word, not yours, Catholic.
Well, they were devout Catholics, my adopted parents.
Devout. Okay. Fair enough. So talk about, you know, so you were raised Catholic, and what happened next as you were growing up? How did your, change?
I thought that if anybody had a direct line to God, it had to be my mother, you know, Mrs. O'Brien. And when one day when she told me matter-of-factly that I was going to hell, it seemed like a sentence had been passed. On another occasion, I dropped a knife at the table, and she said, aha, you see how God worked? You were going to take that knife and do something bad with it. And this is just a plastic knife that we were using when we had our fish and chips. But she says, you were going to take that knife and do something bad. God made you drop that knife to alert me to you. And I thought, really? Did God do that?
See, Mary, people who behave that radically, I kind of question. Now, it's okay to be a devout Catholic. I'm Catholic also. I was raised that way too.
Yeah.
Okay. And there are certain ways that you convey the message of Catholicism to either your youngsters or to anybody else that you care about. And
right.
Mrs. O'Brien's approach to me is very, very radical.
Yes, it was. But I didn't know that at the time.
And you may not have known it at the time, but it was the way she went about it that I questioned.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, instead of helping you and working with you and, I'll say it, and reasoning with you, automatically she says things like, you're going to go to hell. You know, without any real explanation or discussion.
No, she just turned to my father and she said, yep, she's going to hell, you know. See? And my father didn't say anything. He just sat there, you know. He would never contradict her unless she was coming at me to hit me. That was the only time. But I got older, I thought, I don't want God. God's like my mother. I can't be close to him. I can't trust him. So for a long time, I wanted nothing to do with him. But then yes?
Go ahead. Keep going.
When in my 20s, I started meeting people who talked to me about a personal relationship with Jesus Christ and how he accepts people where they're at, you know, as they are. And they, you know, they were talking about how if you put your trust in him, it won't necessarily make the events in your life better, but you have something wonderful to look forward to when you die, which is heaven, you know. I learned all sorts of things, and this was outside of the Catholic Church. I ended up becoming Protestant, and I am born again. I'm a born-again believer. I go to a Baptist church.
So what? I'm just going to go back to a prior comment about your mom.
Yes.
And this strikes me as another way where your disability, your parents and your Catholic Church at the time failed you as a disabled person, not so much as a blind person, but as an ADHD person.
Yeah.
So, and it's just a shame, you know, that nobody could figure out a way of reaching you besides, you know, throwing holy water in your face regularly.
Right.
You know, I'm glad that somebody was able to sort of reach out to you as an adult.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the, and hearing and reading your book about that experience, you know, you clearly did have a conversion experience, you know.
Yes, I did.
You're, for a while, your life was just as chaotic as it was before.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. You were having issues that were.
I didn't realize for a long time how much anger I had toward God.
Sure.
I went through a period in my 20s where I would get intrusive, unpleasant thoughts about God when I was trying to be faithful to him. And I used to wonder where were all these thoughts coming from, but it was because I had a lot of anger buried inside me.
Well, I will assume that where you're born again now, that your anger went away.
Well, the more I learned over the years, the less angry I became. You know, I learned that God doesn't make people do bad things to other people. That does not come from God.
No. It comes from Satan.
And once that started getting into my head, the anger decreased more and more. So no, I don't blame him for anything now.
So the book version that I read was in 2007, right? So that's like 17 years ago.
When I published it?
Well, the version you sent me was the 2007 version. I don't know what
2007. Oh, all right. But it's strange that I put that on there because it was actually published by several different publishers under different names, but they didn't work out. The one that really took was with Ex Libris in 2011.
Okay.
That one was the successful one.
So that book, so it's been 13 years since the book was published.
Right.
How your life has changed since then.
Well, I got to know my biological family. And let's see. I ended up moving to a good place in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Everything's nearby. It's very convenient. I have friends from my church as well as friends outside of my church. And I recently published a children's book, a faith-based children's book on Amazon, Kindle Direct Publishing.
Is that where we can find your original book at?
Yeah, the print edition.
Okay.
Ex Libris is working on the illustrated version of my imagination and art have sustained me.
Right. You're listening to In Perspective. We have about 20 more minutes in the program, and I did want to give our other participants a chance to weigh in on this conversation. It's a very intriguing conversation. Our guest is Mary O'Brien, author of My Imagination and Art Have Sustained Me, and I would like to bring our participants in on the discussion. So let me ask Jeanette if there are any hands raised at this time.
We do have some raised hands.
All right.
Dennis, go ahead.
Dennis, good afternoon.
Yeah.
Dennis? You probably.
Dennis, you're still muted.
Okay.
There you are. Okay, go ahead.
So Mary, I wonder if you can talk about how you arrived at some of the pictures that you embraced as your father, such as Benjamin Disraeli.
Oh, yeah.
B.R. and JFK.
Yes. A lot of them. I often found myself impressed with historical figures, and I would latch on to each one of them and say, he's my daddy, you know, and I'd carry his picture around. I'd pretend to go back in time and get adopted by them. You know, this was the imagination part, how my imagination sustained me. And when I could get away with it, I would draw pictures of them. And not just historical people, but TV personalities, you know, or even somebody, a character from a movie or a favorite TV show. And I've made dolls of people. I have them in my home, you know. I have certain ones that are my favorites, of course.
Do you have any idea why you chose to do that? You know, to draw pictures, dolls of those male figures, those fathers?
I desperately wanted a father who would care and show me that he cared.
Yeah. Yeah. And surely
I wanted to be a daddy's girl. That's why I really, really wanted to be. And there have been times growing up, I would see a little girl who was a daddy's girl and I would become almost obsessed with her. I would try to be like her, dress like her. Talk like her, you know. I mean, nothing really came of it, but I found myself repeating that pattern over the years.
Dennis, anything else?
No, I just wanted to point out that your mother really never had the power of exorcism. That's something that's only done by a very, very carefully and well-trained priest.
I don't know who told her she should do that, or if she came up with the idea on her own. I don't know what her source was for that, you know. But I'll tell you, because she used to do that, years later when I saw The Exorcist, that's when I started experiencing the post-traumatic stress syndrome. Yeah. Because I realized all of a sudden what my mother had been doing and what she must have thought of me. And I was so afraid that I'd wind up like the girl in the movie, but thank God I never did.
Well, the girl in the movie was possessed.
Yes. So my mother must have thought I was possessed if she was performing exorcisms on me. So yeah, in my early 20s, I went through the PTSD. I mentioned that in the book too.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
And this is just another example. You know, I often wonder when Jesus healed those folks who it is said, you know, were full of demons, if they might have had some kind of disability. And, you know, that disability back then.
Well, he cured them no matter what it was. He healed them of it.
Right, he cured them. But it's one thing, it's a different diagnosis to say you're possessed by the devil than you have a disability that we need to address.
Right.
The two are quite different, it seems to me.
There are some schools of theology that do teach that a lot of those were psychological kinds of disabilities.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the society back then had no idea.
No, you're right. You're right. Thank you, Dennis.
Anybody who was different was thought of as evil.
That's true.
You're right. Thank you, Dennis, as always. Jeanette, do we have anybody else?
We absolutely do. Deborah, go ahead.
Hi, Deborah.
Hello. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
You are great.
Well, Mary, I really admire your you know, that you came through, and it's obvious that with the Lord's help, you've came through. And yeah. I got to tell you, I got to be honest with you. I can definitely identify with some of what you were going through. Now I'm totally blind.
Yes.
Blind from birth.
Okay.
I have dyslexia, and they didn't know.
Oh.
The problem was what my learning problem was. And I had a grade 2 teacher that was extremely abusive. And I won't go through the whole thing, you know, through it now. But, oh yeah, she was really, really abusive. And she
physically
was,
too?
Oh yeah.
Or verbally?
Both.
Oh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Smack you across the head and pull your hair.
Yeah. She does. She's going to have a pretty grim eternity if she doesn't straighten up, if she's even alive. You know?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think I'd certainly like to get my hands on that, on that book. I don't know whether is it available in Braille? Does anybody know?
No, it's the Bard Library of Congress. You can borrow it on DB from the library, the Perkins Library.
I'm in Canada here, so.
If you can get on the Bard website, you can download books either onto your phone or onto a flash drive.
Yeah, we don't get the Bard up here in Canada. We do have Bookshare in something called CELA, Center for Equitable Library Services. I don't know whether it's on that, but I just wanted to say that really, really admire, you know, how, you know, I mean, writing this book was, I'm sure, good for you as well, because people needed to know what was going on.
They did.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it helped me to process things in my head better.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, thank you for letting me in on the conversation there.
Thank you.
You'll find a way to get a hold of my book so you can listen to it.
Yeah, that would be.
Unfortunately, it's not on Bookshare. And
I was going to say, you might want to see if you can arrange for it to be on Bookshare, Mary, if that's possible.
Yeah.
Bookshare. Bookshare.com or .org.
Bookshare.org. Yeah.
All right. I'll Google that later.
Yeah. If you can do it, it's well worth it'll expand your reader base.
Good.
Very much so.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thanks, Deborah. Anybody else, Jeanette?
Tony.
You're up.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, Tony.
Hi. Well, you know, so many aspects to your personality, and, you know, you could see how people would mix them all together and probably get confused. And so many aspects to your art, it sounds like to me. I'd like to know how you figured out that you could be a writer.
Because during my 2 years at Perkins, I wrote in a journal constantly. And even after Perkins, I kept journals. And so one day I just thought, I would rewrite the journals and, you know, edit mistakes and add artwork into these hardcover notebooks. And then I decided, why not write a book, you know? And listening to audio books over the years helped me too, to hear how a story is supposed to be related, you know?
All the audio melon.
Yeah, yeah, good.
Listening to how somebody narrates a book, that helped me too.
Yeah. Still, as an author, I commend you, because it's a lot of work and it's hard to do, and you did it. So I commend you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.
Anybody else, Jeanette?
No more hands at the moment.
All right. If you see any, just let us know. Interrupt us. Thank you. Yep. Thank you.
Bookshare. Bookshare.org. Remember that.
So can you, Mary, we talked about your lack of father figures in your life. Talk about your relationship with your father as you became an adult.
What happened was, as he got older, he got grumpier. Now, when I was 17, my mother died, and he came up to Perkins to tell me. He told me she died of a heart condition, which led me to believe that I was partly to blame for being a problem child. And when I graduated from Perkins, I went back to live with him until he died 3 years later, or 3.5 years later. But he was grumpy toward me a lot. He was always picking me apart verbally. You know, this is wrong with you, that's wrong with you. Let me see. I didn't feel like I could confide in him much. I got into trouble where I was sending money to a phone psychic. I thought she'd make my life better, but she was a fraud, of course. And when I got out of that mess, I talked to her.
And Mary, everything you're saying, it comes through in the book, but there's another side that I found interesting.
What's that?
Where two of your Elan friends or colleagues or came to visit you.
Yes, and they walked all over my dad and I.
Walked over your dad, and you, the two of you, whatever your problems were before that or during that time, you know, formed an alliance.
Yes, we did.
Which I thought was sort of remarkable.
Me too, but it didn't last long. And then I found out when he was dying, I overheard him telling a nurse that my mother died of colon cancer. Yeah, I did a double take.
Which you didn't know before that, I imagine.
No, he told me she died of a heart condition when I was 17. He told me that.
So how come, why the discrepancy?
I questioned him about that, and he said he was afraid the other kids at Perkins would shun me if they thought I had a mother that died of cancer. Never mind that she was my adopted mother. He still thought the kids, you know, they'd be like, ew, get away. You have cancer cooties or something like that. That was his answer.
I have more faith in the kids than he did.
Yeah.
I think so. So what is your... Talk a little more about Perkins. You know, you came from a really dysfunctional and destructive place. And on one hand, in your book, it clearly changed your life, right? You learned a bunch of things. You made lots of friends.
I did.
And at the same time, you were rebelling at Perkins too. There are moments.
Yeah. During my second year, things were a little different. They were more regimented than my junior year, you know, and I was reacting to the stress. So I did rebel a little during my senior year there, but I still wanted to be there.
Sure. Well, and looking at your schedule, your senior year, that was good. You know, yeah. I was mainstream and was very, very busy, but the schedule that you had to deal with was pretty intense.
Yes. That's just, and other people, I noticed other students were having a hard time dealing with the stress too. There were, you know, sometimes fights or, you know, somebody yelling at a teacher, things like that, you know.
And you were there at a time when Perkins was evolving into a special needs school.
Yes.
Before 1971, Mary, before Benjamin Smith took over as the director, Perkins was run almost like an institution, and most of the kids there were academically inclined. There weren't that many special needs kids at Perkins prior to 1970. When the system started taking kids away from Perkins and bringing them back into the public school system, Perkins needed to fill those slots. And to make a long story short, they brought in more special needs kids as the 70s went by, close to the 80s. And you were a witness to that.
Yes, that's true.
At the same time, Bob, though, and again, I'm not a Perkins alum by any stretch. I never went to Perkins. At the same time, while they were bringing in people with multiple disabilities, they increased the stress of the program, which doesn't strike me as being especially smart, but what do I know? You know what I'm saying, Bob? What's that? I'm sorry?
I feel the same way as you.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to make it just like a regular high school, giving people a short amount of time to get from one class to another or to take a break. You only get like 10 minutes. So you pretty much have to stick close to the classroom or you'd be late. You mean they did that when you were there too?
We had it. We had 9 periods for the most part in upper school, and the recesses were 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the afternoon.
That sounds about right. So you didn't really, you didn't want to go too far. That's for sure.
Well, you didn't want to be late.
Right. Exactly. Now they have all these special needs students there, and they have more problems than we had, but that's still the same, the schedule, you know?
Bob and Peter, I just want to let you know you've got about 7 minutes left.
Any Thank hands you, raised?
You're welcome.
Any hands raised yet? Okay.
No hands.
Okay. I'm thinking about my high school. I think we had at most 8 periods, maybe 7. You know, from 8 in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Just strikes me as sort of really weird that Perkins would have such a high stress program. You know, there's this, you know, from an outsider, it just seems unnecessary. But, you know, again, I'm an outsider. So, you know, what do I know? So are you working now? What is your sort of employment situation? I know you talked about your book about working in various shelter workshops and...
I used to, yeah, but they don't really have those anymore because the work goes overseas now.
Right. So what do you know,
we have a hand raised.
Let's do it.
All right.
Brittany, go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah, Brittany.
I just wanted to say that it amazes me that you were just so open in your book and stuff. I haven't read it yet, but I just downloaded it, so you may have a fan soon.
Oh, wow.
I downloaded it on Bard, so I'm going to listen to it. It's really enticed me today. I've had a lot of situations in my own life. I'm not going to go into them, but, you know, you kind of inspired me to open up about mine later on in maybe a future book that I may write because I'm thinking about being a writer myself. So
I hope I do inspire you.
And God has certainly blessed you, obviously, because you're still here today. So, you know.
Yes, you're right.
So thank you for letting me speak. And that's all I got to say. You may have
Thank you. And
God bless.
I'm glad you downloaded the book.
Thank you, Brittany.
So talk about your sort of, what are you doing work-wise these days?
I'm trying to get back into drawing on a regular basis. I'm thinking of writing a second children's book and maybe a third. It'll be a series. It's about these two kids. It begins with this little girl named Sarah. Her best friend and her best friend's parents die in a car crash. And they go through the funeral and she asks why. Why do people have to die? And she's told about the Lord and about heaven. And then the one family member that was not in the car was the little brother named David who has autism. And so he gets adopted by Sarah's parents, you know, but I want to make like a sequel to it and another sequel after that. I just did my first picture for the second book. Sarah gets a new best friend, a Spanish girl named Lydia, and she has a mischievous brother named Diego. So I have Sarah and her little adopted brother eating ice cream with the two Spanish kids. Only little David, he's got the chocolate ice cream all over his face. And some of it's on his hands, you know.
Mary, Bob, we have one raised hand and you've got about 3.5 minutes.
Thank you, Jeanette. Who do we have?
575 ending in 970.
Okay.
Yes, that's me, Beth from New Mexico.
Hello, Beth.
Mary, I'm going to read your book too because I didn't really care for public school either. I went.
No.
And I guess they thought that was the best thing to do for us, but I think they should have asked us what we wanted.
I think so too. People back then just didn't do that with kids, and they should have.
No.
Kids didn't have much of a say back then like they do today.
No.
Whether people think that's good or bad, that's a subject for another day.
Yeah, but it's true. They hardly had any rights or were allowed to have opinions back then.
Right. So I want to read your book and I think I'll be inspired by it.
Oh, I hope so. I really
and
do.
The Lord has really blessed you.
Yes, you're right.
And
I didn't realize that.
One of the things, I'm sorry.
No, I didn't.
Go ahead.
I didn't realize it, but giving me the ability to draw and to have the imagination that I have, those were blessings. I didn't realize it years ago, though, but I do now.
Right, and I liked working in sheltered workshops, too. I don't know what they would like us to do. They keep complaining that we're high unemployment rate above among the blind, but not everybody wants to work in technical stuff.
Beth, I apologize. Mary, I apologize. We are down to our last.
I understand.
We are down to our last 2 minutes, and
actually less than that.
Oh,
we have to wrap up and close out before the 60-minute time slot runs down. So, Beth, thank you for that, and I'm glad that you.
Thank you, Beth.
Mary, one more time, tell us where we can get the book.
You're welcome.
All right. The Bard Library of Congress website has my book, My Imagination and Art Have Sustained Me.
What is the website?
Bard. I don't know.
That's okay. We'll Google it. We'll do that. That's fine, Beth. I mean, Mary, we'll Google
and
it.
I'm going to try to get it on Bookshare, too, so that more people can read it.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us this afternoon on In Perspective. Good luck with your future books. Sounds like you're doing a great job. Peter is also a writer. I'm also a writer, so we all must stick together.
Yes.
We all have the same thing in common. Motivation's a part of it.
It is. Big part.
Thank you very much, Mary, for being with us. And thank you to Peter, of course, and to Jeanette and everybody else who participated on the program today. Jeanette, of course, for being our host, and Peter for being the co-host of In Perspective. Go safe with God's abundant blessings. I'm Bob Branko. Have a good week, everybody.